I've been asked to entertain you this afternoon for those people who aren't so interested in the cell phone session going on next door. So I'm going to try to tell some stories about things that have happened to me in my research that I think have some interesting things to tell us about strategies, techniques, goals we can have in order to be effective at, I think, what many of us really want to do in the area of computer security, which is make the world a better place for many people. So let me start with just a few words about myself and my background. I'll go back just a little bit to my great-grandfather, Max Ovanka, who was an artist born in Croatia of strange parentage. Apparently he was the illegitimate son of Habsburg nobility, and the legends go that he was raised by peasants up until his teenage years, when someone came in a carriage one day and brought him off to live in a castle. So my great-grandfather went on to, from this strange twist of fate, go on to art school, become a well-known artist in his country, and but he never really lost track of that peasant upbringing. All of his life, his career, his paintings were really focused on social problems. They were directed towards looking outward at the problems of the poor, the problems of the immigrant classes after he came to the United States, the problems of people around the world who had different opportunities than he did. And although he came to the United States, eventually he was seduced by my great-grandmother, who went to Croatia to marry an artist and found my great-grandfather and decided he was it. And brought him back to the United States, and here she is, holding my grandmother, who went on to be a spy, as did her husband. So this is where I come from. But the lesson I take from all of it. One thing my great grandfather said, I'm told all the time, was to look. To look at the world, to look at what you see, and to think about it. That was sort of his motto, and I think it really informs my work and is at the core of computer security, really, because the first thing we need to do is look at the world before us, at the technology, its strengths and failures, and move from there. So the story will begin in Princeton, New Jersey. Princeton is a lovely place. I spent almost 10 years there as an undergrad and a grad student. I didn't enjoy my undergrad days so much, but grad school was great. I was at CITP, the Center for Information Technology Policy, where Ed Felton, who you can see there on the right, advised me. And Ed's really a fantastic character. Soft-spoken Midwestern guy who, if you interrogate him enough, you'll find out that he played college football back in the day, albeit for Caltech. And Ed brought some really wonderful characteristics to the center. He motivated his grad students to work on applied problems of importance to a great many people. And so we did, such as testing in this photograph whether miraculin, the miracle fruit, really would change our taste of sweet and make us taste, our taste of sour and make fruit taste intensely sweet, as well as beer taste intensely sweet. This is a great thing to look up if you don't know. So we, many people, probably a couple of the Princeton grad students are here, and they can attest to an environment this was at CITP, and still is, even though Ed this year is off as chief technical advisor to the Federal Trade Commission. We poked fun at each other as grad students. One day I gave this to Joe Calandrino, who just gave the talk in the last session. Will Clarkson, who's also here, has been doing experiments in my office, and so I came in one day to find dozens of speakers, and he came in the next day to find this. When I was a grad student there, I came into the lab one afternoon to find that Bill Zeller, who we all miss very much, had taken a picture of me and a web application called Rasturbator and blown it up a zillion times to a full wall-sized thing that you can see behind there. Apparently they missed me when I wasn't there. But we had a great time at Princeton. My first semester as a grad student, I got involved in a project about digital rights management. Now, DRM, we all usually think of in terms of media files that you might download from the internet, but back in the day, this was about 2003, and people still cared about these, audio CDs. And the music industry in particular was looking at ways that they could take audio CDs you might buy in the store and prevent you from rip mixing and burning them, that is, making copies or sharing them with your friends. They tried this for several years, and I actually followed the technology over this time, and it was quite interesting to see the way it evolved. But the first generation of these discs had a problem. That is, technology that was preventing people from copying them was something that was stored on an extra track on the disc towards the outside edge. And in fact, the way the discs are manufactured, it creates a little line around the circumference where that transition occurred. And someone figured out that if you just went out to the store and bought a felt tip pen and drew a line on the right place on the CD, you'd obliterate the copy protection mechanism and you'd be able to go back and copy the disc. So this was the state of the technology back around when I was looking at it in 2003. But my first month as a grad student, I was looking at a new generation of these discs and discovered that they worked in a different way. Rather than making changes at a very low level to the data structures on the CD, this new round of a copy protection for CDs used a very different mechanism. And I can still remember when I found out what they were doing. It was late at night in the fall in Princeton, a very, very pleasant evening. And I came back from a computer lab where I had made this discovery, and it was just such an aha moment. They say there aren't eureka moments in science. Some people who are non-scientists do, but I think everyone in this room, if you're a practicing scientist, you know that's not true. There are eureka moments, and it's just the greatest feeling in the world when you realize that you've found something, you've discovered something, you've proven something that no one else knows. What I found that September evening was that this particular new form of copy protection worked by installing software on your computer that would sit between your audio CD drivers and whatever program was trying to rip the CD and actively interfere with it. Now, that's a really underhanded way of doing DRM, but it has a slight corollary, which is that the way the software gets onto your computer in this old generation is via the Windows Auto Run mechanism, which is relatively easy to disable. In fact, one way of disabling it, just standard Windows thing, is if you hold down the Shift key while you're inserting a CD. And I went on to write to just put up a web page explaining this, a technical report. That this copy protection could be disabled and, you know, it wasn't very effective. This is how it works. Oh, and by the way, if you hold down the Shift key, you can copy the disk. But it turns out that DRM is defeated by shift key makes a really great joke for tech people. And so there was a huge public outcry about this, outpouring of interested people. It got a lot of attention. And the company that made this technology, a company called Suncom, that's their logo on the right. Their slogan was "Light Years Beyond Encryption." had been selling this to the music industry as the next big thing, and when it came out that this was easily defeated, their stock, they were traded on the pink sheets, their stock price declined by 80%, and the next day they threatened to sue me. So the threatened lawsuit against me, my advisor, Princeton University, etc., for DMCA, they weren't really clear. I never received a legal threat, but their press release said they were going to sue me. Their threatened lawsuit generated a whole new round of bad publicity for the poor company, and which I later learned their previous business before DRM was they were in the business of booking Elvis impersonators. But this dealing with this publicity, with people really being interested in my research for the first time, and with really watching how being technically correct actually is worth a lot in this world, a lot more than some cynics ascribe. This was really my introduction to the world of speaking to the public about my work and about security results, and observing what the reaction would be. So the shift key fiasco blew over, and it wasn't the end of compact disk DRM. In fact, about 2 years later, there was another round, and it involved the Suncom company and their technology called MediaMax, and another company which made a technology called XCP, which they called the true meaning of audio security. I investigated how these worked too, and found some really rather disturbing things. So it turned out that these technologies, both of which were being deployed by Sony BMG, at the time the world's largest record company, worked by installing software onto your computer, but that in particular the XCP technology tried to take the next logical technical step, that is, prevent you from uninstalling it. And in order to do that, I and others noticed the technology worked by installing essentially a rootkit onto your computer. There was a driver it would install that would conceal the presence of every bit of the software on your computer by intercepting the API calls that the system used to list files, registry keys, etc. When I reported this on the Freedom to Tinker blog, this contributed to another tremendous public outcry against Sony, because rootkit is a nasty word, of course, but it turned out to be a lot more than that. The more we looked at this software, the more we found out that it was just riddled with security problems. First of all, it created certain privilege escalation vulnerabilities. Second of all, if you worked hard enough, you could get them to provide an uninstall tool, but the uninstall tool opened a remotely exploitable vulnerability in your system that would persist even after the rest of the software was gone. We went back and forth with Sony in a rather unfortunately public way about this again and again, that they thought they had fixed the problem and we found new problems. A delightfully public way. Thank you, Matt. So this generated... So this generated a huge amount of negative publicity for Sony and for the companies designing this technology. And this technology, if you think about it, it's trying to do the impossible. It's trying to take a legacy data format and that has to still be compatible with CD players and cars and a bazillion other devices and lock it down and change it. And it's not technically feasible to do. And so when we investigated this, when we knew what the outcome would be from the beginning, that this wasn't going to work. What really surprised us, though, was the amount of collateral damage that the technology did to non-infringing users just who put the CD into their drive in the process of doing that, which is why I'm happy to say that the negative publicity that this got killed the technology. There has not been a wide-scale deployment of CD-DRM since then. And it's in part because the defects in this technology forced Sony to recall something like 10 million albums, I think, 10 million CDs over the Christmas holiday. It invoked multiple class action suits. It caused states' attorneys general to look into the company, and I think eventually they, the settlement that they, the company reached, required them to avoid doing this in the future. But what we learned about DRM is that it wasn't just one technology. Both of these technologies, made by independent companies, caused collateral damage on users' computers. They exposed users to security flaws. In the desperation to do the impossible, these companies were taking really grave risks with people's personal computer security. So that is sort of what we learned from DRM. And people paid attention, though. So this first quote is from Sony. That's what they were saying at the beginning. Most people, I think, don't even know what a rootkit is, so why should they care about it? Luckily, Stu Baker responded and let them know that it's not just it's not their computer. It may be their intellectual property. So we had a good time with that. And doing this in public, though, I think was interesting. We every step along the way, Ed Felton and I blogged about what new problem we had discovered or what new fix Sony had proposed on Freedom to Tinker. And Freedom to Tinker, or if you don't know the website, this is now the website of Princeton's the blog a blog centered around Princeton's CITP, but it started with just Ed and a little bit of contribution from me. Being able to get our findings out there, get public feedback, go back and forth, and really show people, speak directly to the public has been immensely valuable. One thing that Ed has held as a rule since the beginning that I've now adopted in my own work is not to give journalists exclusives, not to go to the press ourselves. We'll write up what we find, put it on the blog, and tell the story in our own words. And then if people find it interesting, they can report on it. If people don't find it interesting, they don't have to pay attention. But in any case, we are the primary source. This lets us be in control to some extent of the message of how it's put out there. It certainly lets us exercise engage in the exercise of translating what we found, what our science is, into language that normal, non-technical people can understand. And I think building up that skill is something that I know is an ongoing lifetime challenge for me. As the work gets more complex, speaking about it to the general public becomes hard. But one of the important things I see there is communicating to people why the discovery, whatever it is interesting to technical people. You know, you don't make it interesting by turning it into something it's not. This isn't interesting because quantum effects might someday lead to time travel. This is interesting because we've learned something very specific that has the following impact on people. So That was my early experience, my first couple of adventures with this and doing science that people care about, and science that is done and communicated in a public way. So from there, much of my attention turned to voting, where much of my attention still is. And is there an audio cable? Is there an audio cable that I can plug in here? Oh, wait, here. Does this work?
Let's find out. I don't know.
So voting is an interesting problem because at least I find it endlessly fascinating because the technical challenge is so great. We want simultaneously to have something that's very high integrity, but also something where the voter's ballot is a supreme secret, that the voter can't prove how they voted to someone else, even if they want to. And that's important because that's what prevents coercion and vote buying. Now, the technology of voting has evolved over the years. Here I have a video of myself voting on a lever machine in Pennsylvania, where I used to live before they got rid of it. And you can see there I am. Here I'm going to pull the big lever that actually casts the vote. So here I've attacked my own voter secrecy. I've attacked the confidentiality of my ballot. Illustrating here a little bit of an attack. I could have edited it. It would have been tough with what was available at the time on cell phones, and I could still show it on my phone. But yeah, it was a little bit higher resolution originally. But anyway, those lever machines were great because they were big, bulky. They looked like they were designed by someone who knew something about mechanics. But it turned out that they had really lousy security. In fact, I hear stories that the way people would cheat on lever machines, one good way to cheat would be to open up the back, and you'll see there's a little gear and sprocket mechanism for each candidate, and you could take a piece of pencil lead and jam it in the gears for a candidate you didn't like, and it would cause it sometimes not to increment when the lever was pulled. But over the course of election day, that pencil lead would wear down, and eventually the gears would start turning again. And although that candidate would have lost a number of votes, at the end of the day, all that would be left would be a little pile of dust. So the lever machines, though, have their legacy. These machines are what many of the regulations and policies for technology in voting were thinking about, or appear what the legislators who drafted them were thinking about. And so if you looked at the regulations for voting when I started working here, the federal requirements involved things like drop tests and tests in warm and cold weather and so forth. They were almost all about physical factors like that. There was nothing serious about the computer security aspects. Despite that, electronic voting came to prominence, and really after the 2000 election debacle with Bush versus Gore, they started to become very widespread in the U.S. In fact, Congress set aside something like $1 billion to help states buy new voting technologies such as these electronic voting machines and replace their antiquated systems. The problem was that the companies that made these machines tended to rush them to market without really much security thinking or engineering going into it, and election officials couldn't tell the difference. This particular machine, the Diebold AccuVote TS, was the most widely used electronic voting machine in the country at the time that I started working on this in about 2006, but it had never been the subject of a third-party, independent, truly independent from the manufacturer, security review. Luckily for the general public, the Diebold Corporation had some early security lapses of its own, including putting the tarball of their CVS repository up on a public FTP site where some people grabbed it, and it was later studied by people in our community, by Yoshi and Avi Rubin and a group of people. And they found that in that code was abundant evidence for security problems. But still, no one had ever been able to do a hands-on review of the system as it was used by voters, and the company just said, well, all of this stuff is theoretical, it doesn't apply, it's an old version of the software, and by the way, these researchers are idiots, and we're going to threaten anyone who might give a voting machine to researchers to study with the worst possible sanctions. Some people were threatened with being fired, with being sued, and so forth for just expressing a willingness to have researchers come in and study an actual machine. That changed in 2006 when Ed Felton, Ari Feldman, and I got our hands on an AccuVote TS machine. And the story, it's really, you're not going to believe the story of how we acquired it, but I'll tell you, I was the one who actually had to go pick it up. This involved me driving up from Princeton to New York City in a white sedan and double parking the car in front of a Times Square hotel. I then proceeded to walk around to the alleyway behind the hotel where a man in a trench coat gave me a large leather briefcase containing the voting machine. So we proceeded to work in secret, not even telling our own colleagues that we were on this project because of the company's litigious character. We spent most of that summer in a basement room that wasn't on any of the floor plans, working to reverse engineer enough of the hardware and the software to do a security analysis and see if we could actually demonstrate the kinds of security problems that Avi and Yoshi and so forth had earlier found in the leaked source code. By the end of the summer, we were able to come forward with video and a demonstration of our results. So here's the machine with our mock election on it, George Washington versus Benedict Arnold, so as not to offend people of any particular party, except maybe the Tories. So we did an election. In our demonstrations, we would do an election where people would vote for George Washington or Ben, and usually everyone voted for Washington. At the end of the election, the machine would ceremoniously print out on its little paper tape the results, the total votes for each candidate. So if we have 5 votes for George and 0 for Ben, here's what the machine prints at the end of the election. Benedict Arnold wins. Now this is because basically we summarized our findings in 3 points. The first was that we could write malicious software that would change the votes on the machine without leaving any easily discoverable traces. Here's a picture of our malicious software. You can dial in on the screen the fraction of votes that your preferred candidate will get. And of course, we emphasize that a real attacker would be somewhat more stealthy than this. The second thing we found was that installing malicious software on the machine was pretty easy. In fact, with about 30 seconds of access, either physical access to a machine or to the memory cards that the machines use to load ballots and offload results, we could install that malicious software. And it turned out that there was a magical file name that if you had a file with that name on the memory card, the machine would happily replace the contents of its internal storage with the contents of that file without any confirmation or signature or prompt or anything that might make sense. And the third thing we found was that we could leverage this kind of automatic installation as well as other security vulnerabilities to construct a voting machine virus. And our virus would spread from machine to machine over the course of an election cycle or two and take control of all the machines in the jurisdiction, in the county, in the state. This was by far the most alarming thing that we found, because we realized that voting machine security wasn't just about the security of single machines, it's the security of the whole system, and it's possible to compromise the system so easily just from any point of entry that it's really a threat to the integrity of the election in the entire state that uses it. And despite these findings, unfortunately, these same machines are still used statewide, at least in Maryland. I'm told that Maryland is still paying for them, and that's why they haven't gotten rid of them yet. So there was one other aspect. Of course, we were criticized by Diebold, the manufacturer, for not considering the physical security features that the machines had. And the main thing they meant by this was apparently the lock on the side of the machine that you needed to open to get to the memory card. But we looked into this a bit more and found there were some problems with the locking mechanism. The first thing being that all the machines use the same key, including every machine in Maryland and Georgia, for instance, which both used it statewide at the time. And, you know, you unlock it, then you get the memory card. But also, the lock was easy to pick, and I eventually was able to do it in about 10 or 15 seconds with picks, a little bit longer with a paper clip. We learned, though, that picking the lock was probably not even the preferred route that a criminal would take to exploit this, because the key, we Googled it, we Googled the number that was printed on the key. I think it was C415A, something like that. And we found that it was being sold very widely on the internet, but not for use in voting machines, but for use in things like mini bars and jukeboxes, which also use the exact same key. So we thought we were done there. But then we looked at the Diebold website, and Diebold, it turned out, was selling the key in its online catalog. But no, wait. They're not. They weren't stupid. They would. They made sure that you were already a customer and had bought voting machines. However, they did have a nice high-resolution picture, which I've blacked out. I've blacked out part of it to so as not to expose the security, because the picture of the key had enough detail of the way it was cut that a Freedom to Tinker reader went to the hardware store and bought a similar key and filed it down and sent it to us, and it opened the lock on the voting machine. So Diebold, the Diebold Corporation, was a source of great fun for us in the day, but unfortunately this couldn't be a more serious issue. Because this is a place where the security of this technology goes right to the heart of our democracy, right really to the process by which democracy operates. That the security is just so bad that we can all laugh at it is a testament to the sorry state that that we are in with electronic voting. After our study came out, though, after we came out with these findings, that was enough to push some states into action. In particular, California, where Debbie Bowen there in the center, organized what she called the top-to-bottom review. That's the Secretary of State of California. And she instigated a review of the security of every electronic voting machine used in the state of California. That was the declared scope. And she told the manufacturers that you have to provide source code for your machines, or we're not going to allow them to be used. We're going to decertify them. They're not going to be used in California anymore. And she also brought in many people from the security community, real EVT types. So I was lucky enough to be part of the team that reviewed the source code for the Diebold system. And in fact, here's the report that we eventually produced. What we found was that newer models of the Diebold system suffered from the same problems. Their optical scan machines suffered from problems. The source code was riddled with things like with exploitable buffer overflows and so forth. And there were even easier ways to make viruses that would compromise the system. And even in a single election, you could make a virus that would infect the central counting servers, take control of them, and then the next time they produced ballots, hitchhike out into the field and exploit another buffer overflow to take control of the machines. Other teams analyzed systems from other manufacturers, from Sequoia and from Hart InterCivic, and found similar problems that these other systems also had extremely alarming security problems. So if anyone thought that this was just something related to a single machine, a single manufacturer, the California top-to-bottom review proved them wrong. So after, one thing I want to mention here is that working on election issues with government officials raises some interesting questions. So this is an elected politician who's asking scientists to examine the machine she was elected on, find vulnerabilities in them, and tell her, and then she's going to decide whether they can be used again next time. So this kind of practice in general requires very, very careful thinking and planning on the parts of the participants. In particular, we wanted to make sure that we were going to be able to tell the public what we found in enough detail for the public to be able to decide whether the voting system was trustworthy and whether whatever remediation the state took to try to fix those problems was sound. And that's what we eventually did by releasing these reports that are very, very detailed, that withhold only things that would basically immediately make the system easy to hack for the bad guys. And the state followed through. They decertified the worst of the machines, the DRE machines, the touchscreen machines, and their use in California was significantly curtailed after the study came out. Now, I happen to find attacking voting machines fun as well as quite interesting, and so I worked subsequently on a couple of different projects involving taking apart machines used in other states. Here's one of those machines. You can see it's almost the size of a refrigerator, and that's Andrew Appel at Princeton, who bought several of these machines, government surplus, for about, I think he bought five of them for something like $82. I forget the exact price. But they've been hanging around in Princeton since then, and it turns out they're the same machines that are actually used to cast votes in Princeton. So on election day, the faculty who vote there can walk out of the lab and over to the polling place and see the same machines they have at the office. Ari Feldman and I spent, about half a semester as grad students taking this machine apart and examining the circuit boards, and the boards are some of them were monstrous in size. And we found that we traced every circuit on every board and made schematics and reverse engineered the hardware completely. It's all ancient Z80 stuff. If anyone thinks that attack research is easy, think again, because that was incredible effort. We then paired up with these guys, with Hovav Shakam and Steve Checkaway, and Steve spent something like a year, is that right, reverse engineering the software side of things, building a working simulator, and perfecting a really, really interesting kind of attack against these machines. So these machines implement a rather curious security feature. They have a hardware-based circuit that ensures that if instructions are loaded from a location in volatile memory, in the machine's RAM or its battery-backed storage, those instructions can't be executed or it will cause a hardware fault. So it's like it has WXOR X in circuit. This is great, or at least it seemed great back in the 80s when the machines were developed, but that was before the development of return-oriented programming. What we found in this study, and what Steve was able to demonstrate, was attacks against the machine that would use return-oriented programming to completely bypass this kind of execution prevention and allow us to make a memory card. There's a memory cartridge for the machine that was loaded with a return-oriented programming-based attack, take control of the machine, and steal votes. So again, whatever security was designed into these machines when they were manufactured, even if it was pretty good, as it was with these machines, just couldn't withstand the test of time. And 20 years later, 25 years later, however long it was, those security features were nullified by advances in attack research. And when you think about embedded systems like this that have to last for decades and continue to perform at a high level of security, the challenge of electronic voting seems all the more daunting. After this, I thought I was done with breaking voting machines. But then this guy, Jeremy Epstein, came to Princeton one day with a machine that he had purchased government surplus, an AVC Edge machine. And Ari Feldman and I were just goofing off over the summer and thought, well, should we, is this worth serious research? No, the science has already proven that these things are insecure. And so we thought, what would be more fun than just hacking the machine to steal votes? So we looked at it a little bit and noticed that first it was a 486, and second, it booted software from this removable compact flash card. And we decided, well, let's run Linux on it. So we got it to boot Linux, and that was fun. Then we got it to boot X, and then we decided what the ultimate application for this thing was, and we got it to play Pac-Man. So we turned it into a Pac-Man machine, and you know, this hammers home the point that if we can make it play Pac-Man, then, well, we can certainly make it steal votes. On the serious side, the technology in voting does have some promise. So while actually using the machine to count and store the votes is extremely risky because of these kinds of security problems we found, there have been a lot of advances in the field about using computers and technology to help audit the votes, to help secure the election without having to trust those computers absolutely to do the right thing. In particular, one of the favored kinds of technology among researchers these days is optical scan, especially precinct count optical scan, where the voter fills out a paper ballot, puts it through a scanner at the polling place, and at the end of the day, you're left with a ballot box full of votes and a computer record of what the total should be. And at that point, it's pretty hard to cheat because you have to cheat by modifying the electronic record and the paper records in a way that they agree with each other. But this is just so long as we actually go and audit those records to make sure they match. So this is one of the challenges now, is to get states to routinely do audits and do audits up to a statistical level of confidence. And you can see here a demonstration of two different ways of doing auditing. On the left is what most states do now, auditing precinct by precinct. You can imagine the blue balls and beads are places where some fraud has occurred. And one thing that is coming out of the research is the observation that if you're auditing that way and you just pick a ball from the glass on the left, your odds of finding fraud are very low. Whereas on the right, you might think of this as auditing ballot by ballot. And if you pick the same volume size sample from there, your odds of finding a blue fraudulent unit are very high. So we have ways now of using technology to assist and let us do audits using the methodology on the right, auditing ballot by ballot. So there's hope of using computers, scanners, and other equipment to make this kind of audit, this very efficient, very high probability of finding fraud audit, happen. And that's where I hope that voting technology will go. Unfortunately, we're moving into an era where there's a lot of pressure on states to do internet voting, in particular internet voting for absentee voters and those living abroad. And after I started my job at Michigan as a professor, I got to be involved in this a little bit. First, a little bit of Michigan. That's Peter Honeyman, if anyone knows Peter. And this is Michigan, where my first month on the job, I got into my car one morning and the thermometer read 20 below. But I have a nice sunny office, and this is where this work takes place. So last year, for the general election, Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia government, prototyped was going to field an internet-based voting system. This would allow voters to log in using a credential they received in the mail, download a blank ballot, and upload the completed ballot back to the web. What could go wrong? So here's how the system looked. So they did a lot of things right, including open sourcing the software. So this is a version of their server that I was running. So the voter would log in by putting in their credentials, just confirm that they were who they said they were. Then they would get to download the ballot. Here's a ballot. We're filling it out in Acrobat Reader. We save it to disk. We go back, upload it. Okay, and it says thank you. So that's the DC system. Now, many researchers before this this system was operational complained that, well, this is probably a very bad idea because we don't really know how to secure internet voting to a level where it can withstand attacks from serious people. But Washington, D.C. decided to go forward anyway, but as a consolation to the researchers, they said, well, a few weeks before the election, we'll open the system and allow anyone in the public who wants to try to attack it. I said, wow, that sounds great. So my students, Scott Walchok and Eric Wistrow, were recruited to stop the research that was going to help them get PhDs and spend a period of time looking at the DC system. So we downloaded their source code, which was open source, and started scanning their demonstration network and discovered some pretty interesting things. I think in the first couple of hours, we were able to take control of the networking equipment. Cisco 123 is not a great password. And then from there, we proceeded to look at the actual source code to the voting server software. And again, the people who are building this were were well-qualified web engineers. They did it with Ruby on Rails. They were careful. But even then, they were human beings, and humans make mistakes. And one of the mistakes, which we found after a few hours of reading the source code, turned out to be something that we thought was remotely exploitable. So we prepared to launch an attack during the demonstration. So in preparing for the attack, the first thing we did was lots and lots of surveillance. From our network scanning, we found out that we could actually see into the server room on some webcams that they had set up there. We could see the admins walking in and out. We could see the security guard. And, you know, by watching the people who were walking into the server room, we got some idea of whether our attacks had been discovered. Were they really, really alarmed, or were they relatively calm-looking? So, after we... So we waited until after 5 o'clock, when they usually seem to go home, one day, about 2 days after the system went live, and I asked Scott and Eric to launch the attack. So the key in my office is something I made as an undergrad in an art class, and it is the key to the room in which the giant printer it's printed on is. And the key says duplication prohibited. But it contains all the information you need to duplicate it, so it's sort of a DRM metaphor. So here is the place where the bug was that we exploited. Has to do with the code that they're using to, what they do is every time someone uploads a ballot, they encrypt it with a public key and then store the public key encrypted version. The corresponding private key is kept offline and only used for counting. But the code that they use to encrypt it, they invoke GPG on the shell, at the shell, and they sanitize the file name of the ballot correctly, but they failed to sanitize the extension. So we could make upload a ballot file with an extension that was specially crafted to include shell commands, and thereby execute commands with whatever privileges the voting server process had. So using this vulnerability, Scott Walchok, who is a really, really good systems person, created an interactive shell that would let us basically have a terminal into their system. And we proceeded to carry out steps that we thought a real attacker might take under the circumstances. The first thing we did was change all the votes. We replaced all the real ballots with these fake ballots that... we then set up some code that would replace any future ballots with ones that were for these same candidates, and also send us a copy to violate the secrecy of the voters' choices. We then found another vulnerability that apparently every time someone uploaded a ballot, before it was encrypted, the system kept a temporary copy around in the temp directory, and we could use those to find out how all of the past voters had voted, even though their ballots were encrypted. Finally, we were really interested in this. So, I mean, the fact that the system was insecure doesn't tell us much. This is exactly what scientists had predicted. But what we really wanted to know was how well could the election officials respond to this? How long would it take them to discover this? What would their reaction be? And so this was a kind of... inadvertent experiment that we were able to do with them, thanks to their setting up this great test for us to do. We didn't tell them about the problem right away, but because it was they were going to open up the server for real voters, they had said about just a few days after the test was due to complete, we wanted to give them some chance of finding it and reacting. So we left a calling card. Our calling card was we modified the source code to the thank you page that you get after voting, so that after a delay of about 15 seconds, the web page would start playing "Hail to the Victors," the U of M football fight song. "Hail to the victors, valiant, hail to the conquering heroes, hail, hail to Michigan." Any Michigan fans in the room? Anyway, despite this, it took two business days before the election officials noticed and took down the system, and even then it was only because another tester, who I don't think is in the room, complained on a mailing list that the officials were reading that he didn't like the music that played, that that it was distracting. Anyway, Washington, D.C. Decided not to use this feature with their voters during Election Day, and I would like to give them credit for making that because of the security failings, but it may have also been because one thing we discovered in the temp directory, in addition to ballots that users had uploaded, was apparently something someone had uploaded during testing to see how the system would respond if someone uploaded a really, really big PDF file. And this tester just found the biggest PDF file on his system and uploaded it as a ballot to make sure it would be rejected. And this thing turned out to be the 500-some page mail merge of the credential letters that were sent to the real voters containing the real login information for every real voter. And it was, of course, too late to mail out new passwords to everyone. So that was the Washington, D.C. system last year. We'll see what they do next time. So thank you. I just bought on eBay a few weeks ago an AccuVote TSX and have discovered so far, as I reported in the rump session last night, that it contains the ballot information for all the real voters who used it. So you can't throw these things out in the trash safely. We can figure out how everyone voted. The votes are stored in order and we can decrypt them using vulnerabilities published in the top-to-bottom review. However, what we don't know is what kind of video game system this can be turned into, and I hope to answer that in future work. So, really brief interlude, and then I want to talk about one more voting system of great importance, which is what happened in India. I spend a lot of time in airports in my job, flying about because of various conferences like this and international work that I've been doing in things like voting. And in particular, Newark Airport seems to be a place I frequent quite a bit because Newark Airport in the New York area is a big hub for the Star Alliance. This is the air train at Newark Airport. If you've ever ridden on the air train, you'll notice that door is usually closed, but you'll find that you can probably poke it open with a pencil, and there are the controls for the train. I wouldn't want to mess with them myself, but also at Newark Airport and in other airports like that, they have now naked scanners. How many people have been naked scanned so far? These are the machines that see through your clothes. Right, so the magic words, if you don't want the government to be looking through your clothes, are opt out. That's all you have to say, and then you'll have a government employee feel you up instead. So I was going through Houston International a few months ago on the way back from a professional engagement with Ed Felton and Jeremy Epstein, and we got to go through TSA together, and because we're all security people, I thought it would be interesting to at least make a record of it. So I was allowed through without any kind of pat down or scan, but Ed Felton behind me, when he avoided the scanner, was promptly asked to be patted down, and they proceeded to give him the pat down, presumably because he was too obvious about avoiding the scanner. At that point, I took out my camera and was going to take a video of him being patted down. When the TSA agents told me, no, you're not allowed to photograph at the checkpoint. I said, that's strange. Your website says I am allowed to photograph at the checkpoint. And I loaded their website where it said, yes, you're allowed to photograph at the checkpoint. And the TSA agent said, no, you're not allowed to photograph at the checkpoint. Then they said, they changed their tune and said, well, this isn't the checkpoint. The checkpoint is only the other side of the metal detector, which also didn't make any sense. So they brought their manager down to speak with me, and their manager told me, yes, like it says on the website, you are allowed to photograph at the checkpoint, but we want to ask you some questions first to make sure you're not a terrorist, because photographing at the checkpoint is very suspicious. So they asked me, well, why did I want to photograph at the checkoint, etc. By which time Ed Felton was done. But Jeremy here was going through, and it was his turn, so I just turned over to him. Let's see if this works. Oh, you can't hear him. Anyway, he's saying, what he's doing is perfectly legal, and he proceeds to, as he proceeds to get patted down. Anyway, you can't hear Jeremy, but it's kind of funny. Then the checkpoint supervisor told me what their real concern was. He said that some of the TSA agents are aware that videos of them doing their job are ending up on YouTube. And the checkpoint staff thinks that this is a severe violation of their privacy. So, yes, having to go through that just while you're doing your job, I thought, as a business traveler being subjected to pat down and naked scan to do my job. Yes, all right. It's a violation of your privacy. So one day, though, flying on JetBlue into Kennedy Airport, I had one more interesting security experience, and this is that you may know that at Kennedy they have the old TWA Flight Center, the old the great architectural landmark. One of the first modern airline terminals, and it's been closed for years, ever since TWA went under, but JetBlue bought it and has just recently opened it to the public again. But this was maybe a year ago, and I didn't know whether it had opened yet or not. But flying in, I decided I had a few minutes extra, and I'd go take a look. So I scouted out approximately where it was, just looking out the window, and proceeded to walk in that direction. And I noticed there weren't any signs for it, but these looked like the doors to enter. So I went through the doors, and found myself here, which is the landmark entryway tube. There are these very modern architecture tubes to get into the different parts of it. But when I got to the other end of the tube, I discovered it was still a construction site. They had just left the doors open and didn't really give any indication that it was open or closed or not. But I tried the doors, and it turned out every door was still open. I could get into the underbelly of the terminal. I could get into all the beautiful spaces and structures there. I wish I had more photographs to show you. I could get into the baggage handling area. I could just free reign of this architectural landmark and real modern airline terminal. So if you've ever thought about what the spaces, the interior and exterior, and especially the administrative and private and mechanical spaces in an airline terminal are, you can imagine what this was like. It's just far more that's closed to the public than whatever was open. And here I discovered at the end of my tour is the security guard who is asleep in his truck out front. All right, India. So about a year and a half ago, I got an email out of the blue from someone in India asking whether I would go there and take part in a symposium on electronic voting. And they were looking for Western experts to just go there and I presume just speak and take part in some press events and so forth. And as I learned, India, the world's largest democracy, is also the world's largest user of electronic voting. When I got there, India is one of my favorite countries to visit, and so I gladly accepted. And when I got there, I found out that the only other person who they had been able to rope into this from the tech community was Rob Honkrijp, a good friend of mine and a Dutch hacker who happened to be the guy who took apart the machine they used in Holland and make it play chess several years ago, getting the electronic voting machines banned there. So Rob and I began in India what ended up being a great adventure. Now, to give you a little bit of the flavor or the chaos, if you've never been to India, it's hard to really understand what a marvelous mixture of old and new, east and west, order and chaos the country is. Here are some metal detectors, and you know they're made of wood, which of course makes sense. You can't make them out of metal, but just piles of old. This is the market, one of the markets in Delhi. Piles of mechanical whatnot, and also goats. Telephones, old telephones, and here's a new telephone. This is actually one that sits on the GSM network. The country is just overrun with cell phone users, but for people who can't afford their own phones, they also make frequent use of things like this, which are just a dedicated desk-style phone that happens to use GSM to connect to the network because you don't have wires everywhere. So after we got to India, we learned a lot more about their voting system. It turns out that these are the machines that India uses. They're a homegrown system. They're designed and manufactured by a pair of government-owned companies, and they're marvelously engineered for elections in the state of India. Each machine is independent. It's standalone. There's no programming. There's no offloading of ballots electronically. It's just a pair of units. On the left, a ballot unit that the voter interacts with in a voting booth. On the right, a control unit that an election worker uses to allow votes. And they're joined by a physical wire. So on the ballot unit, you have a button for each candidate. You also have a printed ballot. And the ballot has a symbol for each candidate, and this is because many voters either are illiterate or are illiterate in whatever script the ballot is printed in. There are many, many different scripts that voters might know or not know. The voters' experience, they just walk into the booth, press a button, the machine beeps very loudly, the light next to the button lights up, and they're done. It couldn't get much simpler than that. The control unit that the poll workers use is also beautifully engineered. You see these doors that are open in the picture. It turns out those doors close, and each door gets a seal put around it. And they break those seals in a certain sequence that enables different functions at each stage in the election. It's kind of a state machine built out of wire seals and procedure. They zero out the machine before the election by pressing a clear button. They then seal it up and press the ballot button once to allow one vote, so every time a voter walks in. Then at the end of the day, they press the yellow result button, rather not at the end of the election day. And when it's time to count the votes, they press the yellow result button, and the machine shows how many candidates each button number received, how many button presses, how many times was button one pressed? 7. It shows this on this LED display. And they literally will, in front of a room of people like this, hold up each machine and press the result button and let it cycle through the results like this, showing total votes, number of candidates on the ballot, and how many votes each of them received. These machines are a beautiful design, but India made claims that just wouldn't hold up to scrutiny about them. They said that the machines were the Election Commission of India, this is their symbol, the country's highest election authority, claimed that the machines were perfect, that they were infallible, that they were tamper-proof, that there was no need for technological improvement. And yet they weren't really willing to let anyone look at them. At the same time, many people, including people I met on the trip, like the author of this book, were worried about the machines. They realized that they believed that fraud had occurred and was continuing to occur. And there are many, many reports, some of them documented in this book, of candidates or office holders being approached by engineers who offered to fix the machines for a fee, of machines that had glitches that are on a technical level square with possible ways to tamper with the machines, of election outcomes that just didn't make any sense. So despite all of this, despite real reason to worry, no one had ever done a study. So it was against this backdrop that we got to India, and Rop and I found ourselves immediately thrust in front of TV cameras. People really wanted to know what Western experts thought about the machines, which, by the way, were a point of national pride. Hillary Clinton had praised them for being such a great, simple design that worked in the Indian system. But we suspected that there would be problems, and all we would need to do to demonstrate this was to get a machine. So while we were there on this trip, though, by a wonder of serendipity, we met this man, Harry Prasad. Harry is an engineer in Hyderabad, and an entrepreneur, a college dropout. He runs a prototyping firm there. And Harry, now for sure, and probably at that time too, is India's foremost expert on electronic voting. Harry had been approached. He had tried to get the Election Commission to allow him to do a study some months before, and had actually demonstrated problems by making a look-alike machine himself. It looks just like the real machine, but it outputted fraudulent results. So he was well known, and a couple of weeks before we arrived in India, he was approached by an anonymous source who offered to let Harry do a study on a real machine. So Harry met up with us in India, and we were just incredibly thrilled that he actually had a machine. Here we are in his office in Hyderabad with the machine. We proceeded to take it apart and actually try some attacks. And you can imagine doing this in the environment of India where everything is such chaos, but luckily he had some very good engineers working for him, and they had already done some of the reverse engineering, and we were able to go from there to develop some attacks. Here's the motherboard inside the machine, and you can see we've covered up the speaker with a piece of tape. And the reason for this is that with the case open, it was just so loud that while we were working late at night, the ear-piercing beep would wake up dogs all around the neighborhood and therefore wake up everyone all around the neighborhood. But so we had a pretty great time taking it apart and documenting it. So here's what we eventually developed attack-wise. What we learned about the machine was that it's very simple electronic design, embedded processor with all the software burned into it at the factory. So no updatable software. Votes were stored in these small chips. There are a couple of serial flash memory chips. The only other component in the control unit is this daughter board that actually has the LEDs that show the votes. So this is what we did. We first decided to attack the machine by replacing this component. So the reason we did this was I wanted an attack that we could develop quickly. I actually learned about 5 days before I left for India that there was going to be a machine we'd have access to. I thought I was just going for a workshop. It turns out it was going to be a hacking adventure. At that point, they had some rough schematics, some rough description, and I went down to my security class and asked if anyone in this room, any of the grad students in my security class, knew how to make a circuit board. And one of them, Eric Wustrow, raised his hand and very foolishly volunteered to help out with the project. So what we decided was we would develop a look-alike of the board that shows the results. And our result board looks just like the real one, except for one small change. Underneath those LEDs, we've added a microcontroller and some other components that do essentially a man-in-the-middle attack on the results as they're displayed. That way, our software can replace the real totals with fraudulent totals when votes are counted. So if you have temporary access to this, you can change the result. There are just two problems. One, how do you tamper with the machine? It's going to be in storage. There's physical security. Well, we found out that the physical security, the seals on the machines, consist of this. They're wax and string. That's the first line defense for the votes when they're in the machine. So I think some of you can figure out how to compromise that. The second problem is if you put one of these dishonest boards into a machine, how do you tell it who should win? Because presumably you want to put it in there and have it cheat for years to come. And each election, your candidate of choice might be different. So we came up with another way of signaling to the machine who should win. And that's what that black box to the right of the M is. That's a Bluetooth radio module. And so we built an Android application that my grad student Scott implemented lets you pick who should win remotely in the voting booth or during counting time. We implemented one more attack that I'll show you really quickly. And this is if the machine's already been used to vote and it's between polling and counting, which in India could be a period of weeks, maybe you want to open up the machine and rewrite the votes that are stored inside. Harry and his engineers in Hyderabad invented a way to do this and reverse engineered the software format, but it involved attaching lots of little tiny clips to the machine. It took maybe half an hour per machine. So my students and I brainstormed a way to do this more efficiently. And this is what we came up with. This is something we call Clippy. And Clippy is a little device that hooks up to the machine with the power on, and rewrites the contents of the EEPROM memory chips with different votes. You just set the knob to the number of the candidate you want to win, and Clippy does the rest. So we think Clippy is a demonstration of how even your unskilled goon labor could get into a warehouse full of voting machines and change enough votes to affect the election outcome. So that's what we did in our time in India, but I want to tell you what the reaction was. So we ended up developing these attacks over a period of weeks. We hoped to have everything work while Rop and I were in Hyderabad. And in fact, our dishonest display board attack did work. But we wanted to perfect them, to write a real research paper, to package these findings in a way that average people could understand, and that took months of additional work via video conference to Hyderabad. Eventually, though, we released a paper which appeared at CCS last year and put up a web page, and Harry went on Indian television in the local languages and described the findings. The word got out, and the reaction in India was mixed. People were very interested in this, but the Election Commission, who were well trusted, said this is nothing to worry about. This isn't. They initially said it wasn't even a real machine. They later had to correct that. And for a while, it seemed like people were going to take them seriously. But over the summer, word was still percolating in the Indian press about it, and we convinced representatives of the Indian government to come to EVT, the voting technology conference at USENIX last year, and to tell their side of the story. And I think this was the real turning point. Here's one of them. This is their chief technical expert and a former president of an IIT. And he's not moving.
This is something that you must bear in mind. It's different between possibility and probability. It's highly improbable. You can say that I'll end up by telling a true story. There was a gentleman who was in the CBI, which is equivalent to the FBI. He was the number two man there. He got a huge file. It was about export of mangoes. And he said, I'm a police officer. Why should I be bothered about export of mangoes? And why should the file be so huge? It happened because Jawaharlal Nehru got this, somebody sent him beautiful mangoes from Alfonso Mangoes from Bombay. And he said, it's very tasty. You should consider exporting it. And 18 years later, it went to the equivalent of the FBI, saying this, consider the possibility of smuggling and whatever it is of mangoes, because if it is exported, these things can happen. I do not know in those years any mangoes were exported from India or not, but the fact is so many people had such a big file to operate upon. They all were busy, but nobody was thinking of the fundamental issue, namely that mangoes had to be exported. Similarly, we have got a system where we have to run elections with more than 700, 800 million voters on the rolls. And here is a system that seems to work. I'm sure it will have a lot of problems. For example, they said that the display system can be damaged. So we have changed now. We have suggested we must take some changes. I think the Election Commission has accepted it. So that it will not be possible for anybody to change it without damaging it. Because then the machine gets damaged. Once you want to change anything, the machine gets damaged. So there are, similarly, for example, the cable. It was an ordinary cable earlier till about a few years ago. Now we changed the cable. They were connected to the two machines by some simple screws. The connectors at the two ends, they were connected with simple screws. Now they are all sealed. So as and when the complaints are made, which we think there is something that should be done, the Election Commission, I find, they do react. They do take changes, they do make changes. But if you were to say, now look, we are going to change the whole system, That, I think, is a highly improbable one. This is my personal view. Things may be possible, I do not know, but I do not think it is probable. And therefore, we have to work in a system where you can make elections work. And there are many people who can talk of all sorts of problems that could occur, but then, is it possible? Is it probable? Now, these are the kinds of things that one should bear in mind. Please remember, if you want to escape a nuclear holocaust, the best way is you become a cockroach. Then you will be able to survive much better than others. That's, maybe it's possible. I do not know what will happen, but I think it's highly improbable.
So that is their lead technical expert speaking to EVT last year. The important thing, other than the fact that he is such a strange, eccentric, purely Indian intellectual type, is that he's admitted that change is possible. And in fact, in the year since then, we've moved almost 360 degrees. But then at that point, their position was still, change is not going to happen. We don't want change. And so they sent, they reacted rather aggressively after the after this presentation at EVT got a lot of negative publicity for them. Once again, the fact that it ended up in the papers, that they spoke before an international audience, and in fact people like Ron Rivest and everyone else at the conference ended up sending a letter to the Indian Election Commission expressing their concern about the security of the system. After that got into the Indian press, they reacted against Harry in Hyderabad. And Harry received a police summons, which you can see here, ordering him to appear at a certain police station at a certain time to talk about his activities. And Harry postponed this as long as he could. But then one night, in the middle of the night, he says about 10 to 15 police officers barged into his home in the early hours of the morning and arrested him. And what they told him was, you have to tell us who the anonymous source was, and this will all go away. So here, I got a phone call from him while this was happening. They took him from his home to his home in Hyderabad to Mumbai, which is about a 10-hour drive across the country. And they were nice enough to take him in an air-conditioned car and to leave him with his cell phone so that people would get to hear, perhaps so that they could know who would be calling him. But I reached him on Skype, and this is what he said. Well, it sounds like it's not going to play it, but it's just extremely emotional what he says as the police are dragging him off. Harry ended up spending about a week in police custody several days before he got to speak with a real attorney, repeated interrogation at the hands of the police in Mumbai. They wanted to know, who is the source of the machine? Just tell us and this will all go away. And Harry, knowing that other people in India wouldn't work with activists again if he revealed his source, if he betrayed that confidence, refused to say who had given him the machine. Meanwhile, there was more tremendous press, including people looking back at us. Here's something in the Times of India saying, the newspaper reports that intelligence agencies have set into motion their network to check the backgrounds of Hari Prasad and his foreign contacts. It goes on to say that they suspect that this may be part of a foreign conspiracy to discredit Indian democracy. So Harry remained in jail for that week. After they finally let him out of jail, he got a lawyer and had the best defense lawyer in India to work pro bono. And they got him out of the jail, but he was basically under house arrest in Mumbai for the rest of the month. At that point, he came before another judge who said enough of this nonsense and sent him home pending later trial, though they appealed it, and this went on for several months. By that time, this issue was taken seriously in India. All the political parties got interested in what Harry had to say. He was really a national celebrity. And in October, almost all the political parties called on the Election Commission to do something about this, to improve the security of the machines. And the Election Commission announced that, yes, they would. Following this, Harry, now out of jail, got a visa to the U.S., and he came and we went on a speaking tour here. And he got to see the U.S. for the first time. And the reason for his trip was that the EFF named him a Pioneer Award winner for the last year for his work in India and the change that it had brought about. And Harry really is a hero to many people there and to me because of what he's done and what he's endured for the sake of his country's democracy. In December, though, it was time for me to go to India. And this is the last thing I want to talk about. It was time for me to go to India and return and talk about how to fix the problems that had happened with the machines. I was invited to a conference there on the subject of educating Indian computer scientists about these problems. A flight that lasted about 14 hours to get over to Delhi. I get out off the plane and, exhausted, go to immigration and present my passport. The guy is very, very friendly. Welcome to India. Have you been here before? Etc. Then he looks at his screen, and his face turns glum and a little bit white. He looks at me, looks back at the screen, looks at me. We later found out what was on his screen. This is what it said. Deny entry to India and notify originator. But I had no idea at the time quite what it said, but we eventually found out that this is what they said. And even though I had arrived with a valid visa issued the week before, there was in the file a blacklist marker of some kind from an originator in the Intelligence Bureau saying, if this guy shows up, don't let him in and call me. So while we were trying to figure this out, they ushered me into the back room and asked me to wait and wait and wait and wait without telling me what the problem was, just asking, what went wrong the last time you were here? We want to know. After the appropriate period of waiting, I realized that it was time for Rob Hongkripe's flight to arrive because he was going to come for the conference too a couple of hours later. And so I went back to where I had been 2 hours before, right outside in front of the passport gate, and waited for him there, and he showed up, and sort of in a daze of what's going on, why are they stopping me? And I say, hi, Rob. Alex, he says. Well, but before Rob arrives, the reason I'm still there, even though they want to throw me back on the same plane, that's what they tell me, we're going to throw you back on the same plane, we're ordering the airline to take you home tonight immediately. I try to resist this as best I can. And here the continental representatives are ordering me to go with them back to the gate and get on the jet. Now, what would you do in this situation? I mean, you're being ordered out of the country. So I immediately call Harry, and Harry calls his friends, and we call the American Embassy. And this is as I'm being dragged to the gate. We start getting our whole network of contacts and friends in India involved, including the Election Commission, which by this time is under pressure to fix the problems and wants to work with us. So they say, we think we can get you into the country, but we need time. You have to stall. Don't get on that plane. Now, as you know by now, I've spent a lot of time in airports, so I know how to go through security quickly, and I think maybe I can go through security slowly. So as I'm walking through with the guards to the security lane, I try to make everything possible go wrong. As I'm waiting in line, if there's an elderly couple in line behind me, oh, please go ahead of me, I couldn't possibly. If my phone rings, I go out of line completely. Oh, hello, yes, thank you for calling back, American Embassy. Yes, I'm in trouble. I lose my passport 3 times. I lose my boarding pass multiple times. I can't get my shoes off. I can't get my shoes on. Eventually, they ask me some security questions. Did you pack your bags yourself? No. Did anyone give you anything to carry? Why, yes. A man gave me a very strange, smelly package. It seems like it's ticking, and I think he might be Pakistani. So I received some of the most thorough security checks I've ever had. And of course, when they finished checking everything in my bag, I let them know, oh yes, there's one little zipper compartment at the bottom that you forgot to open. I think you have to take everything out again. So by the time I got to the gate, the flight was almost an hour late taking off, but they had held it so I could get on it. At this point, the last few feet, I'm literally sitting on the floor being dragged to the gate by the agents. And oh my gosh, when we get to the foot of the plane, about to walk onto the walkway to the jet, out popped these guys, the immigration guys who I had seen back at the desk, and let me know that we've gotten a phone call from someone very important. You can stay the night while we decide. So Rob Hongripe and I spend the night on the couch. Meanwhile, our friends are getting ready to wake up the Prime Minister of India, who is on a trip to Germany, and to get him to personally make the decision whether or not we can stay. He's spared because at the same time, the Home Ministry, Foreign Ministry, Tourism Ministry, American Ambassador, 3 members of the U.S. Congress, several members of the Indian Parliament, are all on the case. The Chief Election Commissioner, the Deputy Chief Election Commissioner, half of the Indian government is worried about how to solve this problem. I get a phone call finally about 12 hours later from Harry saying they've decided they're going to let you into the country. The Election Commission wants you in, and they're going to write a letter accepting any responsibility for anything that goes wrong. The only catch is you're only allowed to be here as a tourist, because that's what it says on your visa. Oh. So no speaking for me, but I do leave the airport finally, and am met by CNN cameras, and also by the day's paper in one of the biggest English papers in the country, where I had I vaguely remembered at that point speaking to a reporter as I was being dragged to the plane from this paper and not being able to get in touch with them afterwards. So I walk out of the airport with this headline, U.S. prof behind EVM study deported on arrival. So we proceed to have the best tourism in India I've ever had. We meet Harry's friends. We meet gods. We meet gurus. We meet Harry's lawyers. We meet the best, though, is we meet one of Harry's backers, a certain politician who was helping him. This man I want to meet because he's India's first laptop-toting politician and really knows about this issue. But I hear he's having a hunger strike on the day we're to meet with him. Okay, a hunger strike. Boy, I guess he'll be in a bad mood. No, I don't know the half of it. So we get about four blocks away, and the streets are packed. This is the man up in the upper left, Chandrababu Naidu. We get into the packed crowd and are escorted as VIPs around up to the front, to the dais where the man is himself sitting. And at that point, we see that this isn't going to be a normal meeting because here he is lying down unconscious in front of a crowd of about 100,000 people. So we're asked to make speeches. I'm not going to make a speech. I have no idea what's going on. Harry makes a long and loud speech, and the only sign of life that I see in Mr. Naidu the whole time is that when Harry makes his speech, he raises his hand and pushes the cotton balls farther into his ears. So this is how politics happens in India, and really, I'm just vaguely starting to get it after all of this time. But what I do know is that this past month, the Election Commission of India prototyped and fielded their first paper trail add-on for their electronic voting machines, exactly what we were hoping they would do. So they've come full circle. So, thank you very, very much for your attention, and I hope you will all continue to change the world through computer security research. Thank you.